care if I need any meditation. Quiet moment. It could be just a simple signal that your body is telling you to rest.
Anybody would like to share their meditation experience? No? And when I first started meditating, I thought to myself, oh, this is such an interesting exercise, because when you come out at the end of every meditation session, your mind is a little bit different. I hope it's a little bit different. Generally, I find that, oh, it's a little bit calmer, a little bit quieter, and then I try at my best to just carry that little piece of calm with me as I get off the cushion and as I try to do everything else. And I think that's where the real leverage lies in meditation, is that slowly but surely you change the quality of your mind. And you might not see results overnight, but as you practice on a longer term basis, you actually realize that, oh, my mind is not the same as it was maybe a few years ago. And I find that quite amazing. They call it neuroplasticity, I think. So it's a fancy scientific word that you can actually change your mind. So the topic for tonight is right attitude for Buddhist living, or right attitude for Buddhists. And personally, I find that to be a very interesting topic, because when I first read it, the immediate thing that struck me was, oh, what is right and what is wrong? And a lot of people would come in with the idea, because that has a certain connotation, as if there is this God upstairs with a thunderbolt just waiting for you to do the wrong thing, and then just strike you as you do that wrong act, right? But, and then I just got around to reflecting in terms of Buddhism, is there right and wrong? And looking back at what the Buddha said at his time, he actually rephrased that. He asked his disciples, what is skillful or what is unskillful? And this was the instruction that he gave to his son. As you might know, his son's name was Rahula, and he ordained when he was 7 years old. So this is a very basic instruction that the Buddha gave to his son. And the Buddha asked his son, Rahula, to think of it in terms of a question. He said, Rahula, you should think of the question as, what will I do that will lead to my long-term welfare and happiness? In that way, you use that as a judging stone as to what is skillful or unskillful. So what will I do that will lead to my long-term welfare and happiness, and for the long-term welfare and happiness of others? And he used the simile of a mirror. He asked Rahula, Rahula, what is a mirror for? And Rahula replied, well, sir, a mirror is for reflection. And the Buddha said, yeah, that's correct. We should use a mirror for reflection. And similarly so, before we act, before we do things, before we speak, and before we think, we should reflect. This act that I'm performing, whether it's through our actions, through our speech, or through our thoughts, is it a skillful action or an unskillful action? He didn't say right or wrong. He said, is it skillful or unskillful? If I do it, will it cause pain and suffering for myself? Or will it cause pain and suffering for other people, either in the short term or in the long term? And if you reflect that way, and you think it's not a very skillful action, then the Buddha suggested, well, Rahula, and he told his son, well, you should try to refrain from doing that. And similarly so, as you are performing an action, while you're doing something, whether it's through your physical actions, through your speech, or through your thoughts, as you are thinking, as you are doing, as you are speaking, have that same attitude of reflection. This act that I'm doing, will it lead to my long-term welfare and happiness? Or will it lead to the pain and suffering of myself or others? And then if you are sensitive to that result and you are being truthful to yourself, then, and you know that it's not a skillful action, then you should refrain from doing it. So before you do something, you should have that attitude of reflection. While you are doing something, the Buddha said you should also have that attitude of reflection. And as you can imagine, Buddha also suggested after you've done something, you also have that attitude of reflection in terms of what you've done. Was that a skillful action? Was that a skillful speech? Was that a skillful thought that I had just done? Did it lead to my long-term welfare and happiness? Or did it lead to my long-term potential pain and suffering in the future for myself and for others? If it was not a skillful action, then I should openly confess it and share it with my trusted friends and teachers. And then make a resolve, maybe I shouldn't do that next time. But if it was a good action, if it was a skillful action, then you should rejoice and be comforted and content that you've done the right thing. So that was the basic instruction to Rahula when he was 7 years old. And believe it or not, with that simple instruction, Rahula made a lot of progress in his practice. Why, you wonder? Does anybody know why? Any ideas? Well, I guess in a way, the Buddha didn't tell Rahula in absolute terms, this is right, this is wrong. He imparted to Rahula a question and an attitude to his practice that made him more reflective in terms of causes and effect. So just being sensitive and being aware of your actions has a lot of benefits. That's the first thing, that attitude of reflection. And second of all, it made Rahula think about the consequences of his actions. And I think it's so true that sometimes we just get so caught up in the things that we do. I mean, who here has been angry in the past month or annoyed in the past month? I know I have. But how does it work? I mean, usually when we're angry, it's only afterwards that we realize, oh, I really shouldn't have said that. Oh, I really shouldn't have done that. But why is it? I mean, why is it that it's so overpowering? And I guess in a way, it's because we don't have that mindfulness to be aware of it on our radar as it approaches. And that force is so overpowering when it does overtake us. It's just got a life on its own. So the Buddha suggested, well, sometimes it's okay if you can catch it before it carries you away, you know, like a tidal wave. If you can see it on the horizon, there are symptoms of a tidal wave, as you might know. There are, you know, the tide goes out, the fish starts flapping around in the, you know, and there are certain earthquakes or tremors and animals behave differently. Same way, if you see anger approaching before it even actually starts, you can see, oh, these are the symptoms of anger. I know this because, you know, I've been paying attention to it so often and in my meditation, in my practice. You are aware of it. Well, okay, say if you're not that aware of it and it actually overtakes you, you still have a chance to redeem yourself. You think, okay, in the middle of saying that harsh, terrible sentence to my roommate for playing that loud music, yes, you still have a chance to redeem yourself. But I know it's quite hard at that point because you're already in the act of saying something. And so I guess for a lot of us, the leverage is after the act has been done. But that's okay. We all have to start off somewhere. And so the Buddha suggested, well, it is good to have that attitude of reflection. either before you do something, while you're doing something, or after you're doing something. And I think for those who not believe that such a simple thing could take you so far in practice, you just look to the example of the Buddha. It was said that on the night of his enlightenment, he divided his thoughts into wholesome and unwholesome thoughts. That was one of the first processes. He had that capacity for reflection, for introspection, to see inside the reality of his own mind. These are the defilements of my mind. And don't get upset over it. You know, that's reality. And these are the wholesome qualities of my mind. Both are equally there. And from that, it's a great starting point for practice, having that attitude of reflection. But obviously, sometimes maybe that's not enough. We need mindfulness, right? That awareness of the things as they arise. And I guess that's why we practice. The idea is to actually develop your mindfulness while you are closing other stimuli off, partially at least, and to develop that mindfulness in your practice on the cushion, so that when you are actually off the cushion, you have that attitude of mindfulness as you do your other activities. Now, mindfulness is quite an oversubscribed word. There is the definition of mindfulness in the present moment, and I find that very, very useful. But there is also another aspect of mindfulness. I wonder if there's anybody here who can tell me the other definition of mindfulness, apart from present moment awareness. The Pali word is sati, and that was in the language of the Buddha's time. Any takers? No? The other definition of sati is recollection. And that is essentially that, the idea of reflection. Recollection that, oh, these were the things that led me to say this last time. And oh, combined with your present moment awareness, you know, oh, right, this is happening all over again. Right. So in a way, mindfulness, when you have both of these elements combined, it allows you to catch that slippery fish, so to speak. It allows you to not get so carried away. And in the beginning, I know it's quite hard. You might boil in anger for, you know, 5 days on. But slowly, slowly, it might be 4.5 days. And I think that's a great improvement, believe it or not. And it really reminds me of Jim Tail, who's actually the next speaker. He said something that really struck me. He said, we Buddhists, we are not perfect, but we are practicing towards perfection. So I like that. It's a nice attitude to have, because we admit that, hey, there are these defilements of mind which overbear us, which carries us away. But hey, we have that attitude of honesty and reflection to actually recognize it and to even smile at it, to laugh at it, because these are our habitual tendencies that we've grown up with for the whole life. We've carried it with us since birth. Maybe several lives, we don't know. So having that honesty is quite important as well. Now I wonder here, since the theme of Bodhi Night is the three poisons, what do you think is reflection the antidote for out of the three poisons? Kendrick? Of his counting the hatred? Yeah, that's good.
All of them,
yeah. It's true, it's all of them. It allows you to actually look into all of them. But it's true, it could also be hatred. And for me, I don't think there's an absolute right answer. But for me, it occurred to me maybe not knowing delusion. Because it forces you to ask that question, what were my actions? What were the consequences? But in fact, it could be all of them. That's right. So that's the first attitude that I find very useful for practice, in my own practice. And why is it useful on top of that? Is that it helps you develop the right understanding of the world. And it allows you to develop the right view because you get an experiential understanding, an experiential wisdom of what were your actions and what were your consequences. And as we all know here, actions and consequences is what? Karma. You get an experiential understanding of how you live out your karma. It's not some metaphysical concept anymore. The Buddha, in essence, by asking us to reflect, we are developing that experiential wisdom. They call it, in Pali terms, bhavnamaya panya, the wisdom that comes out of your own meditation, your own experience. And when we gain this experiential understanding of karma, and by asking this simple question of what will I do that will lead to my long-term welfare and happiness, it has a profound impact. It certainly has a profound impact for my life, because you realize that, oh, if whatever I do have consequences, the simple natural result of that is I will be more careful, yeah? Be more careful in how I do things, how I say things, or how I even think. And it always reminds me of one of my former workmates, because he was not a Buddhist, he was nothing, he was an atheist. And he worked in a restaurant, so we both worked in a restaurant. I was working alongside with him. And just like all people working in the kitchen, he had a very fiery temper. And after work, he'd need to have a few beers to cool off his fiery temper. And then one of the things that he'd always say is, well, you know, Zen, when you die, you know, that's about it. That was his favorite line when he was drunk. And he'd hug me and he'd pat me on my shoulders. And he'd say, when you die, you die. Why worry so much about being a good Buddhist or having a right attitude in life? You just do whatever you want. You know, he's like half drunk by then, obviously. And you might think, oh yeah, you know, I can subscribe to that. And it affected the way that simple view on his life, the simple attitude in his life, changed 360 degrees the way he acted. Because if you think that whatever you do has no consequence, you go do anything that you want. But really, do you think that reality is such that you can do anything you want without consequence? And mind you, here's this guy who would drink till 4 a.m. in the morning and come to work at 8 a.m. He'd come to work still drunk. It's quite an impressive feat. He could actually still cook while drunk. And he'd sleep around with a lot of other waitresses. And mind you, this is a guy in his 50s with a son who's around this waitress's same girl, the same age as the waitress. And the wife was in China. And he'd be so cruel and, you know, unkind, because he was a supervisor. He'd be so cruel and unkind to his staff. And he, you know, that was his view. He said, I can do whatever I want, there's no consequence. But it reflected in the way he lived his life. It reflected in the quality of his mind. You could see that a lot of the times he's so unhappy because you suffer that thing called existential angst. I don't know if you've heard of that term before, but it's like, I've got no meaning to life, you know, it's that gnawing, biting feeling. You could feel it when you talk to him. And obviously, when he slept around, it would affect other people, and ultimately his wife got to know, and that would cause a lot of trouble. And the way he was so cruel and unkind to his staff, it also caused a lot of unhappiness in the restaurant. So, and you could see, even if you don't believe in future lives, or even your karma that's coming back to you next year or 10 years from now, you could see it reflected in the way that he lived his life and the quality of his mind and how he was so unhappy. So that idea of karma is so important. And mind you, there's a good ending to the story, because he actually realized what he had done wrong, and he actually brought his wife over and he confessed, and he actually changed a lot in the time that I've known him. But yeah, it's so important having that right view, as you can see from that story, because it affects how you approach things in life, the attitudes that you carry. So having the right view in regards to karma is quite important. And that's the first factor of the path, isn't it? Right view. Well, some people say it's the end factor of the path, but I say it could also be in the beginning. And there are several components to right view, karma being one of them. But essentially, when the Buddha elaborated on right view, he said the components of right view is there is what is given and what is offered. That means there is the benefit of generosity. There is the happiness that you get from sharing with other people. And giving without expectation. The Buddha said, give without expectation. Give out of the welfare and happiness of others, without expecting anything in return. That's the first factor of right view. And you can see how that's inbuilt into the understanding of karma too. Because when you give, you actually automatically experience the benefits of sharing with others. And actually, in my own experience, I find the happiest people are the people who actually give without expecting anything in return. And it reminds me of Fiji a lot, because I don't know if anybody's been to Fiji here. No? That's why one? Excellent. For those who don't know, the Fijians are a very beautiful people. They don't have a lot of money, but whenever I remember in primary school, even though they would have one sandwich, they would have that kind-heartedness to actually break half of the sandwich and share it with you if you ask. Yeah, they'd openly do it. And it's so beautiful, I find. So that's the first aspect of right view, giving without expectation, generosity. And next is the understanding of karma, which is so important. And the third is the idea that there are contemplatives, there are meditators and enlightened beings who realize the next world and realize this world. And I wonder what's the implication of that. I guess it implies that there is, you know, the benefits of practice. There is this tangible result that you will gain unconditional happiness. That's outside of this world. And that inspires me a lot, because the idea that here is a man who actually, through his own efforts, became enlightened. I could be enlightened too, if I practice hard enough, if I practice faithfully enough. So that's the idea of right view. It actually affects your understanding of the world, and it affects your attitudes that you carry in life. So from right view, there are three things that flow from it. I wonder what's the next step after right view in the Eightfold Noble Path. Does anybody know? Right thought, right intention? Yeah, excellent. And there are three aspects of right intention and right thought. In a way, I translated it as right attitude, because I find in my own practice that this has been most relevant for me. The first attitude, or the right thought, is the attitude of harmlessness. Having the understanding of karma, you understand that just as other people don't want to be harmed, I should not harm others. But just as I don't want to be harmed, rather, I don't want others to harm me. It's that very basic concept, but I think it changes your whole practice. Now, this attitude of harmlessness and harm can be on an external level, and it also can be on an internal level. On that external level, we see harm manifested in the violence that's perpetuated in countries and warfare. And you see that in acts of terrorism, acts of war, acts of murder, of violence and abuse. And even with non-human beings, you know, cruelty to animals, killing, slaughter. Some people hunt for a sport. I never understand how people can do that. And you can see how the Buddha suggested that we can practice this, and it's inbuilt into which precept? The first precept, the idea that we should undertake the training of actually non-harm. And also not only in our actions, right? Because we also can harm other people's through our speech. And you know, they say sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never hurt me. Do you think it's true? I don't think so. And we've got a lawyer in the room whose only way to hurt other people is through words. But yeah, it's so powerful. Or in other ways, if she says. But yeah, I mean, the attitudes that we carry in our speech, so powerful, but sometimes we're just not aware of it. The underlying force that we are talking to put somebody down can be even just a small manifestation of harm in our minds. We're just not aware of it. When we gossip about somebody, why do we gossip? It's because you don't like that person, right? To a very small extent. You might not like to acknowledge it, but yeah, it's a small manifestation of harm that we carry in our minds. Also with abusive speech and lies, in the same way, we also carry that weight of harm in other towards others.